Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And this is the aforementioned Eagle One, otherwise known as Mark Tempest, and Sal is stuck in an airplane someplace, so those of you who are listening today get to listen to my dulcet tones. Our guest today is a really interesting gentleman named Rear Admiral Tim Zeemer, who was the coordinator of the President's Malaria Initiative. And I'd like to welcome him to our show. Admiral Zeemer, are you there?
Yes, I am. It's nice to join you today.
Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. Could you describe for our audience exactly what the President's Malaria Initiative is, sir?
Sure. The President's Malaria Initiative was one of the foreign assistance programs that was started underneath President Bush. If you back the clock up, it's clear one of his priorities was the continent of Africa, and he focused in on education and business development. A couple years into his administration, he realized that the HIV epidemic was undermining both education and economic development. And when he saw the very serious impact that HIV was having on the total population, he launched the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And that has become the engine in turning the tide of HIV, not only in Africa, but globally. About a year and a half after that, it was brought to his attention, and he understood that that malaria was a huge problem as well. In fact, there were more people dying of malaria in sub-Saharan Africa than HIV. And while it focused in on a completely different target and population group, it was having a devastating impact on the continent. And so in 2005, he launched the President's Malaria Initiative as an announceable at the 2005 G8 conference, and pledged at that point $1.2 billion over 5 years to help 15 focus countries achieve the UN Millennium Development Goals. And in malaria, that was to reduce morbidity and mortality by 50% by the end of 2015, which is this year. And so when he launched it, he challenged the other G8 countries to step up to the plate and match the U.S. commitment, and he also challenged the private sector to step up to the plate and participate as well. So that was the birth and the genesis of the President's Malaria Initiative. In 2006, as it was coming together, I was asked to lead it as the U.S. Global Malaria Coordinator. We focused initially to scale up in 15 countries. We started in three the first year, expanded it to seven the following year, and then rounded out to 15 in the third year, and targeted on specific most at-risk population groups, which happens to be kids under five and pregnant women. If you step back and think about malaria, while it's not considered a problem here in the United States, it used to be, but it's no longer a problem. While we still have cases, most of those are imported, we still live in a malarious planet. About 2.5 to 2.8 billion people are at risk of malaria in Asia and Africa. When this program started, over a million people were dying of malaria each year, and 300 to 500 million were being infected by malaria. So it was huge. And 90% of the sickness and mortality was happening in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. And of the mortality, 85 to 90% were kids under five and pregnant women. And so when we entered the 15 countries, we focused on those two at-risk population groups to help the countries achieve their UN Millennium Development Goals. And let me just summarize this series of comments that here we are finishing up the 2013 spending, and 2014 money is now flowing, but we have virtually achieved the president's initial vision of a 50% reduction of morbidity and mortality. In fact, it has become known as one of the most successful U.S. government foreign assistance programs, not because it met a need, but because of the impact that we've had. Last month, the World Health Organization put out their annual malaria report, and they reported that 4.3 million deaths have been averted from malaria. And there's been a drop in all-cause child mortality and, across the board, an average of 59%. So with those very dramatic figures, it's not only recognized by the World Health Organization, but it's recognized throughout Africa as a huge factor in reducing the burden of malaria on the health system.
Has how did you get? I mean, other than the fact that you got appointed to the position in 2006, what was your background that got you in the position to be appointed to this particular job?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm asked that frequently, particularly by scientists and professional public health people and medical doctors. I graduated from college in 1968 and turned around when I got my draft notice, and there were some guys in white uniforms. They happened to be Navy recruiters. And I turned around, dropped my draft notice on the table, and therein lies my entry into how I got into the Navy. I ended up in Pensacola, went through flight school, and spent a career as a rotary wing pilot with the U.S. Navy. So my professional career was, you know, serving the country and the taxpayers at sea as a naval aviator. And I had my opportunity and privilege to command several squadrons and a couple of air wings, and I went into the amphibious route, but my major command was shore, and then the Mid-Atlantic Regional Commander was my last assignment out of Norfolk. When I left the Navy, having been raised in Asia and been exposed to an awful lot of need on the foreign front, I had an inkling to get into something in the humanitarian world. The board of directors at World Relief, which is a faith-based humanitarian organization out of Baltimore, asked me to come up and interview. And to make a long story short, I was asked to join World Relief, eventually became the executive director, and served there for 5 years doing basic humanitarian work. We had five outputs and worked in 26 countries, Latin America, Asia, but primarily in Africa. And that's where I got my training wheels on humanitarian foreign assistance. And then out of the blue, one day after shortly after the president announced the president's malaria initiative, I got a call from the White House and the personnel shop asked if I would be interested in interviewing for this job. At that point, I had no inclination to go back to government. In fact, I pushed it back because I just wanted to stay in the private NGO nonprofit world. But again, not to extend the story, after a couple interviews and looking at the plan and the vision, I told them that I'd be more than happy to serve as the coordinator. As a political appointee, I resigned on Inauguration Day and was asked by the current administration if I would continue to serve as the global malaria coordinator. And so after making sure that what I did and how I did it would remain constant, I told them I'd be happy to continue to serve the U.S. government and the foreign assistance in the malaria world. And so here I am. So it was kind of an unorthodox, unsolicited way of getting to this point. I'm also asked, how does a guy that has basic Navy leadership experience and aviation experience end up in the humanitarian world? I'm the only person in my whole organization that doesn't have a PhD or a master's in public health or entomology or epidemiology. My deputy is a pediatrician who's served years in Africa. So I think it points back to the skill set that most individuals in the military and the Navy and the officer corps has, and that's an understanding of mission, mission accomplishment, focus, planning, working with people, and then making sure that the timelines and the attainment targets are met, and just it's basic leadership management 101. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Well, I know when I was involved with some humanitarian situations during the Kosovo thing that some of the NGOs and IOs and GOs were a little reluctant to deal with me as a military person. Do you see any impact on your background? Does that affect anybody anyway, or are you well past that at this point?
No, that's really a good question, and I think it is an issue, and it's relevant depending on where you are in what organization. Frankly, I experienced some pushback when I went from the military into the faith-based private NGO because there's a subculture and a culture there where rites of passage is really important. Many of the folks in the humanitarian work actually look at the military as part of the problem in some cases, or just don't get what long-term development and humanitarian work is all about. And so it took a while just to understand the culture and fit in. I did a lot of listening and learning, and eventually, just like anything else, when folks realize that you're all about mission and taking care of the team and all, then the barriers break down. In government, the civilian military component it has been an issue, and it has improved because of a lot of work. Everyone recognizes nobody can do disaster response in terms of logistics, management, and getting people on point better than the military. Earthquakes, tsunamis, et cetera, et cetera. The recent Ebola crisis, again, the military is kind of the go-to group because there's a understanding and appreciation of the logistics as well as the leadership component. Where it becomes a little bit more of a challenge is when you look into the long-term development objectives, and that's where it's a work in progress from my perspective of integrating resources, technical assistance in order to come together on the same project. A lot of effort has been is ongoing in that space. I think there's a lot of room for improvement. It's the awareness is much higher, and I think the experience and success is all over the map, depending on the country and the program that you might be thinking of. I know any conflict area, like Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq, clearly is a challenge when you bring the military and the civilian efforts together to do development.
Yes, sir. As you've gotten into this program, have the approaches taken to try and get control of malaria changed? And I guess maybe that fundamentally I'm asking the question: what are the efforts we make to control? How do you control attempt to control malarial outbreaks?
Yeah, if you look at where malaria is today, malaria is categorized in as a disease of the poor. And hence, in many of the more impoverished, undeveloped places in Asia and specifically in Africa. The contradiction is we know what malaria is, we know how it happens, we know what causes it, we know how to prevent it, and yet hundreds of thousands of people still catch it and die from it. So over the years, thanks a lot to the Department of Defense research teams, as well as our research that's come from different universities and the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, we've over time developed very effective interventions. And the President's Malaria Initiative has taken four of those interventions and packaged those in our program. We have, of the four, there are three that are prevention, to keep people from being bitten by the mosquito and to have the parasite injected into their system. The first one is the distribution and use of insecticide-treated mosquito nets. Since the program began, we have... with our partners, the Global Fund, the World Bank, and the British, have seen over 400 million bed nets distributed to sub-Saharan Africa. The second intervention is to use insecticides and spray the indoor walls of homes and the living dwellings of people who are at risk. There has been spraying ongoing in Africa, but it's been hit and miss. It's the principal reason that we got rid of malaria in the 50s. But we have started in all of our countries, but a couple, a very effective indoor residual spraying program. And that's touched about 20 to 21 million households each year. And if you add the cumulative up over the 7 years, it's touched about 10% of the at-risk population group in Africa. So that's the second intervention. It's one of the prevention ones. And the third prevention intervention is we target not only kids under five, but pregnant women. And when the women go into the prenatal clinics for their workups, we... recommend and encourage 2 to 3 doses of a preventative treatment. It's sulfur dioxide paramethamine. And if they have parasites in their system, that'll help mitigate that or clear that. And so that's part of the prevention thinking and planning. We have also introduced rapid diagnostic test kits. If you presented at a clinic with a fever, we'd poke your finger, and within a minute and a half to 2 minutes, this little test device would indicate whether or not you were positive or negative for malaria. And if you are positive, then we make available an anti-malaria drug. There are several variations of them. We refer to them as artemisinin and combination therapies, which this has this wonder drug component that was originally developed in China and is now part of a chemical cocktail, if you will, that's packaged in pills. And if you have malaria and you take the treatment, you'll be back on your feet in 2 days. So that's the treatment intervention. So we, as we've scaled up in all these countries, we've targeted the at-risk population group, kids under 5 and pregnant women, and tried to provide 80 to 85% coverage of these three, prevention and then one curative intervention. So that's how we plan our budgeting and our program. And it's been quite effective. The one point that I often make is while these interventions are not perfect and they're certainly not applied perfectly in every province and district and village and countryside, we still have seen major significant progress accomplished as a result of this strategy in all the places that we're working.
Well, that's pretty impressive. How I know there's some controversy about whether, like these insecticide impregnated nets, whether they're the mosquitoes or the are building up an immunity to these things. What is the latest story on that? And are there new technologies coming down the pike to help correct some of these issues?
Yeah, that's really an important question, because if you look at where we are today and the risks to continue and sustain a program, resistance by the mosquito, we call it the vector, but the resistance by the mosquito is a major risk looking forward, because mosquitoes are not only the most dangerous animal in the world because of all the disease they carry, but they're pretty smart little creatures, and they develop resistance to things like insecticides. The other problem that we deal with is the resistance that the parasite that actually gives you malaria develops. And these parasites equally are as brilliant and develop resistance to the anti-malarial drugs and chemicals. So we have a twofold problem: resistance by the mosquitoes and resistance by the parasites. Now, the point that I think is important for everyone to understand: we had malaria in the United States and we broke the cycle. We still have the mosquito that carries malaria, the Anopheles mosquito. If you have a barbecue in your backyard this summer, you're going to be annoyed by the mosquitoes. That mosquito could carry the parasite if it was around, but fortunately we got rid of the parasite and we broke the cycle. Mosquito nets are designed to help break that cycle, and they a number of years ago, our colleagues at CDC Atlanta and other scientists came up with this idea of impregnating the fiber of the mosquito net with a pyrethroid insecticide. So it not only deterred the mosquito, but it also killed it if the mosquito landed on the net prior looking for someone to bite. Since pyrethroid is the only insecticide used for this impregnation of mosquito nets, and the fact that the mosquitoes now are developing pyrethroid resistance, it is a problem for us. And we are working with some product development programs. We're partners and working with a group out of Liverpool, England, where they're looking at different insecticides that can be used as an alternative to pyrethroids and still accomplish the same effect. Mosquitoes are also developing resistance to the insecticides that we use for spraying on the inside of the homes. Pyrethroids is one of the major insecticides. For years, DDT was used. We used DDT to get rid of the mosquitoes here in the United States and the bed bugs up in New York City. But then when Rachel Carson led the movement to get rid of DDT because of the risks that was perceived in eggshell development and the persistent pollutant effect of that, DDT was stopped being produced here in this country. And as a result, DDT has been on the list of insecticides to watch. The bottom line is it is still on the WHO UN effective insecticide use. It's one of 12, but over the years, the mosquitoes have developed a resistance to DDT as well as a building resistance to pyrethroids. So what we're forced to do is look at the series or the insecticides available, and we alternate the spraying cycle so that we can try to get out in front of the mosquitoes to abate and minimize the potential to develop resistance to any specific insecticides. So let me just stop there to see if you might have any more questions about that particular issue.
Well, I knew that DDT was a kind of controversial insecticide, and because of the Silent Spring, Rachel Carson book, and apparently there's still a number of scientists who are concerned about its use, but there are also people who contend that if we were using DDT, that millions of more lives would be saved if we're you know, because we could get rid of this problem before the mosquitoes, I guess, had a chance to mutate, where they would be immune to it. Am I wrong in that, or is there some? I just know it's controversial at this point, I guess.
It is controversial, and it's I think it's important to understand that everything we do from our programming is in compliance with the environmental regulations, et cetera, both on the international side, the U.S. regulations, as well as the country side, the countries that we're working in. The fact that DDT is on the WHO World Health Organization's approved insecticide list means that it has gone through all of the requisite scientific testing, and there is no evidence that spraying it on the inside of the homes causes any harm to the residents. And so, used appropriately, it is effective, it's safe, and it's the most affordable, and it lasts the longest. But because of the environmental concerns and because of the resistance, it's becoming a less frequently used or available insecticide. There are many ministers of health in Africa that would like to increase not only insecticide, but the use of DDT. For us, the concern of resistance to the insecticide, not from a risk perspective, but an effectiveness perspective, is what we're doing. In fact, since we've started the President's Malaria Initiative, where we had basically zero baseline to measure anything to see how much impact we are having, we have paid for and trained over 100 surveillance sites in the 19 countries where we're working, so that it becomes a technical resource to test for insecticide resistance to bed net use as well as the indoor residual spraying. So there is a capacity building and a health systems building component to our resistance, and it allows us now to make more strategic decisions on the periodicity and the cycling of and when we might need to switch to a different insecticide.
It seems to me that when I was a kid, one of the things they were always concerned about was, and I'll call it draining the swamp, but we didn't want standing water around. There were a lot of reasons for that. But is that an issue Is it a swamp-related issue? There's too much standing water. Is it a rainforest issue for the parts of Africa where your focus is?
Yeah, I think it's a matter of degrees. I think if you look at where the malarious belt is in Asia, it's the warm equatorial climates, and it extends all the way from Asia into Africa. There is no such thing as no standing water and no swamp area. And then when you look at the characteristics of the mosquito, which is primarily the Anopheles mosquito, which is a female night biter, and the characteristics is to fly into a home and bite from dawn, dusk to dawn. That's what the entomologists have figured out. Then when you look at money available and the effective interventions, we haven't focused, nor will we, on draining swamps or providing insecticide treatment on lakes and ponds. We could use up our whole budget in one country doing that at the expense of benefiting from the effectiveness of the four interventions that we're supporting. So there is communication that goes out to the people that if there is a old tire or a coconut shell or an object collecting water, to flip it over because it's a potential source of larva developing. But that's not an area that we're investing money in or focusing in at this point.
How is the response of the countries that this program is in effect? Are they recognizing its worth and appreciating the contributions of the U.S. taxpayer to help out their problem?
Yeah, one of the most enjoyable aspects of my job from the perch that I engage in is that I get to travel and meet with presidents and prime ministers, ministers of health. And I can say uniformly there is genuine, sincere recognition of what the U.S. government has done through their foreign assistance funding for not only for development of roads and bridges and agriculture and education, but in health. And when I step into a meeting, there's immediate recognition that without what the U.S. government has invested, and now we're passing through $4 billion since Bush made the announcement, and we have had strong bipartisan support by Congress to fund this initiative through both administrations. People recognized that not only is the political commitment there and the leadership, but we're providing the funding and the technical assistance that's really turned the tide and reduced the malaria deaths and the unburdening of the health systems in many of these countries. And so there is genuine recognition and appreciation by the leadership and the people for what this program has done for the mother and the father and the child in some of these remote villages.
Well, I was going to ask. I mean, I know that you, for example, got malaria when you were living in Vietnam, I guess. You know, in the movies, it always shows people who had malaria occasionally still get chills and kind of a recurrence of that. Is that an old wives' tale suitable only for World War II, or does that go on now?
I think it's important to understand that there four different types of parasites that cause malaria. The most dangerous parasite is the falciparum parasite, which is the one that causes the majority of the problem in Africa. In Asia, primarily, it's the vivax parasite. And the stories that you hear about recurring malaria is residual and factual from the Second World War, when so many of our folks were in the Pacific. with falciparum, there's no relapse. Once the parasites are in your system, you're either going to stay sick for a while until the immunity for adults deal with it, or you die. Kids under five haven't developed the immunity. Pregnant women have a weakened immunity, and so the impact of that parasite is significantly more severe. With Vivax, there's less mortality, but you still get sick. The chills, the flu-like symptoms, you're just on your heels for several days. Now, there is a possibility for relapse if you have Vivax, and I'm told by the scientists and my experts that typically if it's going to happen, the relapse for the Vivax parasite would happen within 3 to 4 years. So that's possible to have the relapse. But if in fact you're diagnosed with malaria and you're treated, chances are all the parasites will be taken care of and you won't get the relapse.
Ah, well, I guess that's good news. Among the other countries, I mean, you've mentioned that it's a huge problem in Africa, and it sounds to me like if you're able to reduce a mortality rate of 80% of children under five who have acquired malaria, that you're saving generations as you go through this. Is there a similar situation in South America and in Asia, or are they just a completely different ball of wax?
It's a completely different scenario at this point. If you just back up historically, at the end of World War II, there were 200-plus countries that were considered in the malaria zone, including the United States and many of the European countries. Since then, the world has continued to work against malaria, fight against malaria, and right now, according to the World Health Organization, we're down to 104. So we've reduced the malaria footprint by 50% since the Second World War. Part of that reduction has occurred not only in the Northern Hemisphere, but also in Latin America. Now, we still have malaria as a problem primarily along the Amazon River Basin. And our program is working with seven countries, but the whole approach is so much different. We're working with providing technical assistance and coordination, because if you look at the morbidity, just the number of people who are getting sick, and those who are being treated successfully, and then those who are dying, it's a completely different universe. So it becomes more of a burden on the health system and a adverse impact on the population. So I would say if the progress that's being made now in Latin America and in the Caribbean continues as they're moving, we could envision a malaria-free Caribbean and Latin America within 10 or 15 years. Okay. That said, we're not focusing there. We're allowing those countries to do their own malaria prevention and treatment. In Asia, China had no deaths that were reported along the southern Yunnan province. India and Southeast Asia is where the majority of the malaria cases are. And if you look at Southeast Asia, Burma and Cambodia have the largest concentrations of morbidity and mortality, but the number of people dying from malaria in Southeast Asia and India are so much reduced than what's happening in Africa. So we're working right now in Southeast Asia for two primary reasons: to help Cambodia and Burma reduce the footprint of the malaria impact, but then also to work with the research communities and the governments and the Gates Foundation to identify an emerging resistance that we're seeing developed by the parasite to this miracle drug, this artemisinin compound. And so we've scaled up our investment primarily to understand this emerging resistance, to try to not only understand it, but figure out what can be done with it before it moves into India and then possibly into Africa. So again, our focus on what we're investing and how we invest is different in Southeast Asia than it is in Africa. So we're global, but I would say 95% of our focus and funding go into sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, you've mentioned a couple of times now the impact on the medical systems in the affected countries. Let's talk about the total impact on some of the countries in Africa when they are malaria ridden, if you will. What are we looking at? What problems do they face that we're helping them defeat?
Yeah, let me give you a bit of an anecdotal story here. The last time I was in Tanzania, I jumped on a flight and went out to Zanzibar. And the Minister of Health walked me through the hospital, and he's a pediatrician, and he walked me into the child's ward. And he said, when you started the President's Malaria Initiative here, 32% of the kids that presented with a fever had malaria. And he walked into this ward, which was empty, and he said every bed was full, and in some beds there were 2 to 3 children lying in there being treated for malaria. Today, in Zanzibar, the five islands, when a kid checks in with a fever, 0.02% of those are checking positive for malaria. So the beds were empty, and what the message is, by the reduced burden of the clinical work required for surveillance, testing, and treatment and care, it was pretty much eliminated, and that freed up the doctors and the nurses and the expenses to do something else. My deputy, again, who has served years in Africa, showed me a report that in some countries, 30 to 35% of the folks in the hospitals are malaria cases. If you could remove all of those or a portion of those, again, that would free up resources for these overworked, understaffed hospitals and clinics to do other things. So right there is an anecdotal illustration of that. I sat next to the Minister of Health in Tanzania as they were cutting the ribbon on a new blood bank, and I said, so what's the takeaway? And he said, there's a 50% less demand on the blood bank now than there was 2 years ago. And I said, what do you account, how do you account for that? And he said, because the malaria cases have dropped so dramatically, there's such a lower demand on the blood bank. So, you know, that's an indirect aspect of that. So when the burden of malaria goes down, it's not only unburdening the health system, but it also directly impacts the economics of a village, a family, or a community. You might hear people put out a figure that there's a $12 to $20 billion economic impact in the malarious countries in Africa because of malaria. Well, I don't know what that means, because in this day and age, when we're throwing billions and billions of dollars here and there, it doesn't mean too much to me. But I could take you to a small village in Malawi and introduce you to a mother who spends 34% of her disposable income on buying anti-malarial drugs for her kids. Most of these moms are on the under $2 a day threshold. So 32% of that $2 a day is a huge economic impact on her. And that's, and most of those moms have anywhere from 3 to 5 kids. It takes her out of the market. It takes her out of the field. It takes her out of school. 3 to 4 days for every kid that has malaria each time they have it. So you can just see the adverse impact of malaria on families and communities in Africa. Let me just throw out one other thing. When you talk about how malaria links and interlinks with other aspects, if you're familiar again with the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, they set specific targets to achieve by the end of 2015. The first one is to reduce poverty. So with what I just went through, you can see how an improved malaria posture would help reduce the poverty aspect for a mom or an individual in a place like Malawi or in any country. Education is the second Millennium Development Goal, was to improve attendance and representation of boys and girls in school. Well, when a kid does not have malaria, they get the probability of them going to school goes up significantly. The fourth Millennium Development Goal has targeted maternal health, and pregnant women is one of our at-risk population groups. So as we continue to mitigate the adverse impacts of malaria on pregnant women, that also targets an improved contribution to maternal health. And then child survival, our focus group is kids under 5. That's the fifth MDG goal. And then the last one is seeing a reduction in infectious disease, HIV, TB, and malaria. So an effective program to counter malaria touches 5 elements of the development program in cities and communities across different countries in the world.
Well, let's extend that a little bit. How does this program, I would say benefit, but what is the U.S.'s gain from programs like this, fighting malaria in particular?
I would say much of the answer is wrapped into why do we do foreign assistance at all? And if I know your primary audience is a national security and all things maritime audience. Certainly foreign assistance and public health and malaria is not part of national security and all things maritime. But I could make a point that if you, throughout our communities, we understand that there are 3 components of how we do our work overseas. One is defense. The other, it's the 3 Ds. The second is diplomacy, and the third is development. And the foreign assistance and the contributions to health and then malaria fall in underneath the development. And as our secretaries of defense, old and new, continue to say, and our secretary of state and the White House all embrace the 3 Ds as part of the stool for stability, contribution, and business development overseas. And so I think it's pretty much a no-brainer. First of all, it's the right thing to do to help people in need when we have the resources and the know-how to do it. That's just who we as American citizens are. When we have the opportunity to contribute to the stability and the development of communities, putting kids in school, et cetera, that actually provides stable communities and is part of who we are and what we would like to contribute to as American citizens. So let me just, I think most of us understand that, those who are part of your constituency here. But I'm motivated by the fact that this investment in malaria contributes to the greater commitment of defense, diplomacy, and development.
When has there been a, let me read, the question that came up in the chat room is, did the experience that was gained with fighting malaria have any value for fighting the recent Ebola outbreak? Is there a cross connect there?
Yeah, it's huge. There are three of the main Ebola countries in West Africa. We're not in Sierra Leone, but we're in Guinea and Liberia. They had cases in Senegal, Nigeria, and Mali pop up, and they've been able to contain those. But it's huge because it represents the need to develop basic health systems, surveillance, and response when a crisis or a specific medical problem happens. I think it's right now the adverse impact of the Ebola crisis on the programs, our malaria programs has been significant. Liberia and Guinea both are coming out of are in a post-conflict reconstituting situation, and when something like Ebola comes in and trumps the other health initiatives and focus, it pretty much stops us in our tracks or causes a situation where we're going to have to go back and then reconstitute and figure out how do we move forward. There's a direct linkage between Ebola and malaria. First of all, there's still more people dying of malaria than Ebola in West Africa. People who are presenting to an Ebola treatment center, the symptoms that they're looking at, I think there are 10 symptoms, headaches, muscle pain, vomiting, diarrhea, da-da-da-da. Seven of those 10 are the same that you would look for when you're trying to diagnose malaria. So there is a commonality between those two diseases. I saw a statistic a couple weeks ago that in Guinea, where people were being processed through an Ebola treatment center that came up negative for Ebola, 33% of those folks tested positive for malaria. So while there's a significant improving commitment to do something about Ebola, and I'm really pleased at the progress that is being made, even though we're not out of the woods, the problem of malaria has been exacerbated because of the distraction that Ebola has created. So we're going to have to we are currently looking at ways to get the bed nets that have been distributed used. We're trying to get the drugs that are on site at the clinics or hospitals distributed so those people that are presenting with fevers can benefit from these anti-malarial drugs. So it's something our teams on the ground are looking at and are very much aware of.
You know, when I started doing the research for the show, Admiral, one of the things that popped up was a discussion of vaccines that are trying to be developed for malaria. And do you know what the progress of that is, and are they working on it, or is the cure worse than the prevention, in that case, worse than the disease itself?
Yeah, as you focus on the long-term goal and hope of eradicating malaria, eliminating it from the face of the earth, it's going to take something like an effective vaccine. To date, there has been a tremendous amount of good research invested. The National Institute of Health, the Department of Defense, the Gates Foundation, through different research organizations, have invested hundreds of millions of dollars to develop an effective malaria vaccine. There is a vaccine that's being tested right now in a couple sites in Africa, but it's not a cure-all like people would hope and pray for that we saw in polio or some of the other diseases. The, as I understand it, the yellow fever vaccine was effective because it addressed the a virus, and most of the vaccines or all the vaccines that are produced are countering a virus. Malaria is a parasite disease problem, and there has never been an effective vaccine to cure a parasite problem to date. So while there are a number of potential vaccine development programs in place, it's still a number of years off before we'll be able to see the impact and then be able to look at how to integrate that into a strategy to help the countries and reduce the global malaria burden.
You know, here's another question that comes from the chat room, but I'm going to add my own preface to it, which is when I if you go out in the farms of the Midwest now and stuff, there are all kinds of genetic mutations being done to insects that cause other, you know, unable to mate and stuff like that, so that the crops don't get damaged. Is there anything afoot to kind of neutralize the mosquitoes in the same way, some kind of program that prevents them from breeding and just kind of makes them die out?
Yeah, in fact, I don't have the specifics, nor do I understand the science, but I do know, having spoken and updated different universities and research units on what the president's malaria is, there is some pretty aggressive and interesting work being done on exactly that. I don't know the status. I don't know the potential impact or the ability to take a proven science and then introduce it into the world that we're working in and determine that it would have an effect. But I know there's a lot of interest and some pretty smart people working on that. And again, if there's a breakthrough, we certainly applaud that and would be interested in the application.
Well, when I was doing the research, too, that at one point, 2010, I guess, there were 219 million cases of malaria, I think, reported in that year. And you're saying that that's been brought down substantially, but we have a long way to go. As you work through this, you mentioned some partners in these programs, the Brits, apparently, the World Health Organization, and some private enterprises that are involved in trying to work through this problem. Can you kind of discuss who they are and what contributions they're making to this this problem?
Yeah, first of all, looking at where, as far as the global burden of malaria, when the Bush Initiative started in 2005 and the one we're working on now, we celebrate that we pretty much reduced deaths by 50% plus and the overall disease burden by 50%. That is exceptional when you consider where we were when we started and where we are now. But I think it's really important for people to understand that the minute we take our foot off the throttle or the accelerator, malaria is going to come bouncing back like a crazy spring. We've eliminated malaria in several countries several times, like Sri Lanka, where they pretty much had eliminated it. And then in the 80s, they had another 200,000 cases. And don't quote me on those figures. I just pull. But they took their eye off the ball, and they got into another infection cycle. And so as we look at the progress that has been made, we're going to have to take this all the way down to a point where we can the countries are going to be able to get their arms around it and then sustain the gains that have been made. Now, towards that end, if you just look at the math, the funders of the malaria program at the global level are saying it takes between $4 and $5 billion a year to meet the requirements globally. We've only been raising about 2.0 to 2.4 billion a year through the U.S. efforts and the Global Fund, the World Bank, the countries themselves. So there is a gap, but every program and every initiative has gaps to deal with. The people that the partners that we're working with, they're today there's three primary funders of the malaria fight. The U.S. government, we're doing it through this bilateral program called the President's Malaria Initiative, and the Global Fund, which is a financing mechanism that is globally funded primarily by the U.S. and our European allies and the Japanese. And the funding for that goes to HIV, malaria, and TB, and the Gates Foundation. Now, the Gates Foundation is putting in a significant amount of money for the high-end research innovation. The Global Fund and the U.S. government, with our colleagues from the U.K., are putting money into bilateral programs and country programs. The World Bank was supporting malaria directly a number of years ago, but now they've pulled their funding out of malaria, and they're not funding disease-specific programs, but dumping it into different country basket options so that the countries can strategically determine where they want the money to go. So there are three to four principal funders. It's the Brits, the United States, the Gates Foundation, and then this financing mechanism called the Global Fund.
Well, I don't want to stop talking to you, Emerald, but we've already used up over an hour of your time, and I this is a really interesting topic. The people who might suggest this is not the national interest of the United States, I don't think really have an appreciation of the immensity of this problem and the good that you all are doing. But I certainly think you kind of hinted that you didn't know how you got the job. I suspect that you're exactly the right guy to have this job, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be on our show today. Is there any final word you'd like to say before we say goodbye?
No, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to communicate the commitment that the United States government has in foreign assistance and in the disease-specific programs and malaria specifically. It's a success story. We're making a huge difference, and the American people can hold their heads high and be happy that this part of their tax dollars is having an impact. Lives are being saved, and communities are better off. So it's a real privilege to spend a few minutes with you to communicate that message, and I just want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to share a few thoughts.
Yes, sir. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us, and have yourself a nice Navy day.
All right.
Or a great Navy
Thanks
day.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave this friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.